Up North News with Pat Kreitlow is a product of Courier Newsroom and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. You're listening to Up North News.
It is a rainy Friday morning in western Wisconsin, and if it's not rainy by you yet, it probably is on the way. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitlow, and I'm joined now by Mark Jacob, who, by his own admission here, used to edit Page One stories for the Chicago Tribune and also for the Sun-Times, and as his bio says, and these are sweet words to my ears, now allowed to have opinions. He's also the co-author of 8 books on history and photography. And he and I and a few others have been working either through the Courier Newsroom ranks and outside, you know, in other endeavors to essentially bang the drum that while it's important to have, you know, free media, First Amendment and everything else, it's got to be done in a way that is less both sides-ish for the sake of both sides-ish, less horse race, and maybe start calling out people who are trying to burn down the racetrack overall. Mark, it's good to have you here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
You have, for folks that anybody checks out his pinned tweet up at the top, he makes note that, you know, he and I and others in the past, you know, we would try to treat Republicans and Democrats equally. You thought that was the way to be fair. He says when he edited political stories, you went so far as to count the quotes from Republicans and Democrats, thinking an equal number would make us fairer and not think you were helping either party. I remember that well. I would be looking for sound bites. And if it was if the Democrat talked for, you know, 16 seconds and the Republicans soundbite was 9 seconds, I went really hard to try to see if I could find another 7 second, you know, soundbite to go along so that we wouldn't get those angry phone calls. And I, you know, now in hindsight, what a fool's errand that was. It really didn't do enough to pay attention to the substance. And Mark, I think that's those are lessons that newsrooms are still having to learn.
Yeah, yes, and they haven't learned them yet. Many of them have not. You know, and that approach, that kind of equal time approach, makes sense if some amount of sense if both parties are behaving in the same level of honesty or level of corruption. If they're telling the truth the same amount of time, that, you know, that might work out for you. But unfortunately, and I was in the business for 40 years, so, you know, I've watched it happen. You know, if you look back in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of bipartisan scandals, you know, like Keating 5 and Abscam, and the Democrats, you know, a lot of them got indicted. You know, it was one of those things, it was equal opportunity corruption.
Right.
But there's been a real evolution in that. I think maybe you could credit Obama for it a little bit as far as kind of cleaning up things. But if there's just no question from, if you look at things, that the Republican Party is more corrupt now than the Democratic Party. It just is. And I'm not like saying that because I'm not a Democrat, I'm an independent. And I've just been watching it happen. And the fact that, you know, when you just look at who gets indicted, just look at all the kind of stuff. Look at all the people who had to run out of the Trump cabinet because they were corrupt. And when you see that, and then you see the same coverage in major news media where, well, let's bring Mick Mulvaney on to lie another time.
Right.
It's frustrating because it lends legitimacy to people who are known liars who shouldn't even be invited on the air.
As you've written, Hillary Clinton mishandled emails. George W. Bush lied to get us into a war. Both were bad. One was way worse.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with saying that. And now we face, again, at the risk of speculation, because we don't know everything yet. But, you know, a former president does not get his home and his safe searched, you know, just for thank you notes that he writes to a North Korean leader. That we're talking some kind of national security concerns, and they should not be framed as, oh, here's why that's bad for Merrick Garland, or here's why that's bad for Joe Biden. We're talking about the potential for very serious crimes here.
And the more we learn about that, the more we see that the Justice Department tried to give Trump every opportunity to follow the law, and he just simply refused to. I mean, that there was months ago they issued a subpoena that he just ignored. So the rule of law is super important now. And it's and that's part of what I'm talking about, Pat, as far as the Republican Party changing from a mainstream party to a radical, dangerous fascist organization, is the fact that, look at this, look, they're like trying to defund the FBI. They're like, they're trashing law enforcement. Whenever, you know, they're back the blue, except if they're going after us, is what the is their view. Except they should let the Republicans commit crimes. So, right. so it's, and you know, my parents campaigned for Barry Goldwater. It's not like, you know, it's not like I come from some communist cell somewhere. It's it, and I've watched this happen, and it's very distressing to me because, you know, I know why my parents were campaigning for Barry Goldwater. It wasn't because they were right-wing racists or something. It was because they loved American values, and they wanted this country to be safe. And when you see what how the Republicans are, you know, assaulting democracy, and you know this latest scandal at Mar-a-Lago, it's they've trashed the history of the Republican Party, in my opinion.
Well, and it is that utter convenience of when do you back the blue? You know, when do you back the badge? And that you, it is very easy to use, you know, the local badge when it suits you, when you're attacking, you know, quote unquote Chicago or quote unquote Milwaukee, right. You know, versus white collar crime. Mark Jacob is with us. We're going to be joined next by Professor Melissa Scanlon for a bit to talk about the Inflation Reduction Act and climate, and then more conversation with Mark Jacob. This is Up North News. We'll be right back. If you would like to join the show at some point, 715-388-7155 is our phone number, and our email address is radio@upnorthnewswi.com. Pat Kreitler here along with Mark Jacob joining me for the hour. And now we are joined by Professor Melissa Scanlon, Chair in Water Policy at UW-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences, also the Director of the Center for Water Policy. She helped establish Wisconsin's first environmental law firm, Midwest Environmental Advocates, which represents community groups and local and tribal governments to protect their air, water, and land. And we are going to be talking about some of the climate aspects of the Inflation Reduction Act. Professor Scanlon, nice to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
Let's start with the impressions, you know, that a bill did finally get done that is multifaceted, but a big chunk of it is related to climate. In many ways, had this passed by itself, you know, and was simply a climate bill, were you A, surprised that something finally got done, but then B, just overall, your level of satisfaction with what ultimately was able to get passed?
I'm really optimistic that the House is going to pass this today and it will get signed into law. The bill is historic in terms of its investment in a national market for renewable energy sources. I think that from what I've seen in my research on climate change, we have millions of Americans who want to participate in this transition off of fossil fuels, and it's just been really expensive to do it. And what this bill is doing is using Congress's power of the purse to make renewable energy more affordable for Americans.
And it really is in much the same way we talked earlier in the show about the bipartisan infrastructure bill. It is a simple recognition that there are big things to be done. And yes, big things cost a lot, but it's what great nations do is they make those investments rather than continue to let things slide. So that is the overarching national view of things. But obviously on an individual level, people are wondering, well, that's fine, but are we just talking about, you know, raising my taxes so that somebody else can get a tax credit for something I'm never going to benefit from? So let's take it to the individual level and the things that you see in there that many individual Americans will notice at some point as all of this takes effect.
Right. So with gas prices, I mean, they're a little bit lower now, but we've all been feeling the pain of the gas prices at the pump. I think there's a great independence to switching to electric vehicles and having a more stable supply of energy to charge your cars based on renewables. And what this bill is going to do is give tax credits to individual consumers to make electric vehicles more affordable. One of the caveats on it is that the cars need to be assembled in the U.S. So that's also good for U.S. car manufacturers and other automakers who are opening assembly plants in the U.S. That means jobs for people who are in that industry. Yes.
And I would be remiss if I didn't ask, you know, from your standpoint, working at the Center for Water Policy, what in that legislation really speaks to you in terms of, you know, taking seriously the threats to, you know, not just that massive body of fresh water, you know, just over your shoulder, but also, you know, all throughout Wisconsin and the country?
Well, climate disruption is directly tied to all things water. So we need to move off of fossil fuels in order to protect our climate and protect our water supplies. And you only need to look at the headlines from this week to tune into that fact. I mean, California is experiencing a 1,200-year historic drought. You have flooding in Tennessee, right? You have historic records of rainfall in South Korea. That's all this week. Heat waves in the UK and in Europe, drying up water supplies. So it all ties back to water. And that's why I'm really interested in climate policy, because I know that we need to stabilize the climate in order to protect our water supplies.
Mark, you want to get a couple of questions in here for us?
Yeah, I just want to go back to the electric vehicles for a minute. I think Americans still are worried that EVs are too expensive. And I wonder if you could just kind of address the idea that the initial investment may be high, but that overall, you know, in the run of owning a vehicle, it could very well be more affordable.
Well, they are supposed to be more affordable in terms of the mechanics of them, because they have less parts to maintain over time. And a lot of electric utilities are starting to offer incentives now for electric vehicle charging, where you can charge them at night at your home for half the price that electricity would cost during the day. For people who are switching to rooftop solar, we could have renewable energy charging stations that are on people's homes and apartment buildings that really reduce the cost overall. And then the big thing is immediately in terms of air pollution and being able to breathe cleaner air because you're not dealing with combustion engines.
Right.
Now, I don't want to, this is not a panacea, obviously. And if you live in Wisconsin, like we all do, finding a affordable electric vehicle right now is like a search for a needle in a haystack. So what we have with this bill is optimistic, but it's going to depend on supply chains and on all of us making those switches, right, to this new technology. So although the estimates for this bill are that it will reduce our carbon emissions by 2030, 40%, that's really dependent on a lot of factors. And it's dependent especially on, you know, individual consumer choices, like you're saying. So getting over the range anxiety too, and having electric vehicle chargers dispersed so that it's easy for people. That's gonna be another big piece of this. There are a lot of details in the weeds. I think this is a first step. It's something that we absolutely need to do, but we cannot console ourselves and think this is all we need to do. This will take a lot of cooperation by individuals and the private sector to actually be effective.
Now, so obviously your specialty is water policy or one of them. And, you know, I've been looking at what's happening in the West and how, you know, and how dry it is and the drought. And I wonder when that's going to be really in collision with the growth, you know, the suburbanization of areas and just the rapid growth. And when will they actually confront the fact that, my gosh, we've run out of water, we can't grow as much, or we have to even, you know, even get smaller. And do you have any sense of kind of what, I mean, to me, it looks like an impending disaster or that could have really huge impacts in California and the West Coast. How do you view it, and when do you think that will really smack us in the face?
Well, the people living within those environments now are already confronting that with water reductions. All of us who are tied to agriculture being produced in California, that's where we get most of our winter fruits and vegetables. We are feeling that as well, and we'll feel it more intensely as agricultural growers in California need to switch water, you know, from certain crops to others. And it's also interesting because I think we in the Midwest will be experiencing more climate refugees in a way from within our own country, people who want to come to places that are cooler, that aren't experiencing wildfires, aren't experiencing the extremes of drought as much. So we need to prepare for that as well in the Midwest, that we will have a greater surge in population, most likely.
You mentioned the rural areas and farms, and it's not just in California, but everywhere, Wisconsin too. The bill includes more than $20 billion to support climate smart agriculture practices. And while that's a big number, it just means that in all kinds of places, I always think first of Dunn County here in Western Wisconsin and the Red Cedar River, which is just choked with algae every year. And that is despite, you know, decades of attention to it, that there are more projects and better practices that need to be done, as well as $2.6 billion in grants to conserve and restore coastal habitats, which again is not just the ocean coasts, but the Great Lakes coasts, where things are being done as well. But again, Professor, to bring it back to the home level, these are things where if people want to make that investment in their home to make it more energy efficient, what had been something that might have been cost prohibitive before is going to be a little less so.
Yes. And I would suggest people, you know, look at Focus on Energy in Wisconsin, and they have all different contractors who are already pre-approved to put in heat pumps, to insulate your home, to make it more energy efficient. And you can start lining that up now and getting estimates, because once this bill passes, there's going to be, I would predict, a surge in demand for those kind of services. And it's also a great kind of business level of businesses for people, young people who are looking for jobs, to figure out, hey, I want to become a solar installer. This is a great time to make those kind of investments in your careers, to get involved in this industry, this emerging industry that's now going to have a big federal push of money into it.
So what efforts are there to train up people to be solar installers? I mean, I'm just curious, do you have any sense of what supply versus demand is like in Wisconsin?
I can't really speak to that, but you've hit on a really important issue. And that's, you know, that the tech colleges have to be training people for these future jobs, not just the jobs of the past, but I think a fossil-free economy is our future. It is our present that we're moving towards. And we need to have the technical colleges training people to get into those jobs and to really be prepared for that future.
And one more provision that I want to hit on before we run out of time here, it actually relates, Mark, to something you and I were discussing about, you know, the bipartisan infrastructure law and what would it really help with. And you talked about mass transit, and, you know, this bill also includes $1 billion for clean, heavy duty vehicles, transit buses, school buses. And Mark, I got to think the more clean garbage trucks around Chicago, the better it's going to be for everybody.
Really, I'm sure that's the case. See, I'm in Chicago, and mass transit is so important here that it's just something that the government's got to encourage. You know, and I was worried when the pandemic hit, a lot of people kind of went away from public transit and back to their cars, and it seemed like just a terrible trend for a city that's whose air has gotten increasingly cleaner. With, I mean, you know, I was out there yesterday and just looking at the downtown skyline and thinking, you know, this would have looked a lot different if there wasn't a Clean Air Act.
Oh, gosh, you can only imagine. Professor Melissa Scanlon, thank you so much for your time to tell us a bit about the Inflation Reduction Act and the impact that it's going to have in Wisconsin, across the country, and no doubt worldwide. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks a lot for your interest.
We will take a break and be back with more with Mark Jacob coming up next. You're up north.
From Lake Wissota, once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Along with Mark Jacob, former editor at the Chicago Tribune, Chicago Sun-Times, and now do we put media critic on your business card yet? What are we?
Just an unofficial media critic. But having been in the media for four decades, I certainly can spot bad stuff when I see it, because you know I was responsible for bad stuff.
No doubt about that. You're not quite at the point of like Brian Stelter you're not going to have a Sunday morning show on CNN about the media here.
Twitter's about the best I can do, and that's Mark Jacob 16.
There you go. As we talk about recent events and how the media has covered them, most recently, of course, we have the primary in Wisconsin, but we also had primaries last week in Arizona and Michigan. You had Trump and Pence each endorsing different candidates in races in those states, along with Georgia. And look, we know there's an entire conservative media ecosystem. There will always be the right wing. So I'm not going to pretend that that's not going to happen. I'm talking more about your mainstream or legacy media. And as they have been covering both the primaries and other recent events, who's frustrating you most lately with seemingly a slow learning curve on how you cover these things?
Well, everyone really, Pat. It's for example, I think it was the Washington Post had a headline that said, the Justice Department said it was going to be, above politics. Then the Trump search warrant was issued or something like that, which suggesting that the very fact that they went to a judge as they're supposed to, got the search warrant, conducted the search, that was somehow politicizing things. And a lot of these problems like this happen just with kind of someone trying to be loose and clever in a headline on the web or something. I mean, the real scary thing is that some people, when I post about the media, they say, oh, it's all a big conspiracy. They're all just trying to, plotting to get money. You know, having been in the media for a long time, the media is not capable of widespread conspiracies because it's not organized enough and it's not competent enough to engage in a really successful conspiracy. So instead, in my opinion, what it is a lot of people individually just following the pack and doing the same things they've always done. And that whole kind of both sides journalism as a way to inoculate journalists from being accused of being biased. Just put it out, what everyone says, just report it and then you're safe. That whole thing has been around for a very long time. And the real problem is not that journalists have just started doing it now. It's that they don't stop doing it based on these kind of circumstances. So that's, that kind of stuff. And also CNN just bringing on the same old liars. I mean, I just don't. I mean, Kellyanne Conway, really? She's not a government official anymore. So there's really no news value in it. She's on one of your shows to flog her book. Right. And I mean, is there anyone who's more demonstrated that they're a professional liar than Kellyanne Conway? I mean, come on, she's just a liar. So why? So when you bring her in, who are you serving? Are you serving the viewers? No, of course you're not. You're like letting somebody lie to them. You're serving the two-party system. I don't know what you're serving your own ability to fill airtime and and create controversy. And posing as unbiased. I think those are the only things you're serving, but you're sure not serving the reader or the viewer.
And it's not as if they're not hearing the criticism out there or the critiquing, not just from you, certainly not just from me on my much smaller stage, but I think of Soledad O'Brien is especially good at calling out this kind of behavior. Oliver Darcy, you know, does as well, and some others. So again, it's not like they're not clueless about the impact of their decisions on booking, you know, quote unquote experts and commentators on this.
Well, part of the problem with DC media, and a lot of this problem is a Washington media problem, is that they're part of the power structure. It's not that this idea. I always felt like when I was at the Tribune, you know, as Metro editor, if we published a story that made people mad, that was good because the best sign that you're doing a bad job is when nobody complains about you in news media. If you're being honest, because the people on both sides of an issue, or they don't want you to be fair. They want you to be on their side. And so if you're fair and objective and you're fact oriented, sometimes that makes them mad and they don't like it. So I think that in Washington, there's too much of we're going to see this person at this dinner, at this cocktail party, so we're not going to make anyone mad. And so it's to a large extent, I think the problem is that the news media in Washington is too embedded in the whole system, and it's not, and not able to, or not willing to be adversarial the way that really strong watchdog media are.
So let's name some names. I think especially in terms of who do people like the people I've named already, who do they call out? I certainly have a couple that I really am not fond of that I'll mention in a minute, but I think by and large, the number one name that comes up on this list is Maggie Haberman from the New York Times, and which again, I don't pay nearly as much attention perhaps as I should, but what it seems to be is that case of the consummate insider who again wants to not burn sources, but you know, in the meantime, treats some of them with kid gloves or even withholds information because, you know, I might have to write a book someday about it. Is there anybody that gets probably called out more often in terms of mainstream journalism?
No, she does because she's so tied in with the Trumps and they talk to her. And, you know, I think some of it's fair, some of it's unfair. I mean, if you're going to have that beat, you're going to have to be talking to the Trumps. You are. The where she gets, I think where she gets in trouble as far as the truth and serving her readers is when she will tweet just a straight out statement by Eric Trump, for example, that's just a, you know, three sentences worth of lies and just lies. I mean, I'm not talking about bad opinions. I'm talking about factual lies. And she'll just tweet that out with no comment or anything. And so she's using her gigantic platform to amplify lies. And and I think that and there are ways to cast things, you know, that I mean, if you're covering the President of the United States or the Senate minority leader, you sometimes do have to report what they say, even if they're lying. But you can cast it right, said without evidence, or although the facts indicate otherwise, Mitch McConnell said X. I mean, you can put it in a frame that makes it clear what the truth is. But this is, you know, the listeners might have heard this term, but if they haven't, very common in the industry is what we call stenography instead of journalism, which is that's when you're not analyzing anything. You're not going and finding out any independent facts. All you're doing is standing there, listening to people talk, you're writing down what they say and putting that in your story. You're just a stenographer.
That's something that we talked about on Tuesday with Professor Mike Wagner from the University of Wisconsin, is that it doesn't just happen at the small level, at the small market level. There were many times where I had to basically be the fifth year of journalism school for some of these new reporters to get them to not engage in stenography and to actually, you know, ask questions or just pick up the phone and get that bit of follow-up. Right. So when you see that kind of stenography happening at the national level, it's especially troublesome. But again, they can also make you know, just straight up mistakes or, you know, I mentioned a minute ago, you know, Brian Stelter, you know, being a bit of a media critic, and yet this week he too put something up that people second guessed, where he tweeted, more than 36 hours have passed since the FBI showed up at Mar-a-Lago. Officials have not explained why, even though they have a very good reason for staying silent. Well, yeah, you stay silent. You don't talk about the search warrant that you executed. It's not on them to explain. It's something that Trump was the one that told everybody that this was happening.
And Trump had all that material and could release it at any time. And really, the thing about it is, if Merrick Garland had come out and said, we searched Mar-a-Lago and made a big deal about it, that would have been politicizing the issue. And he would have come under incredible criticism. So what he's doing, and sometimes it frustrates people like me who are utterly convinced that Trump is a career criminal and someday needs to be brought to justice. Mm-hmm. People like us have been very frustrated with Merrick Garland because he's doing everything the same way that Justice Department always does things. And which we're not sure how it's going to end because, you know, frankly, they could have done charges right based on the Mueller report and they didn't. And you know, I mean, that was obstruction of justice demonstrated. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so what I'm saying is that they operate quietly. They operate the way they do. And don't you really want this Trump thing to be treated just the way any other criminal case would be treated? I do. I really do. I want it to not look political. I don't want it to be political, except in the idea of saving our democracy. That kind of politics is fine with me.
And that's where, as I was looking to see, I knew I was forgetting somebody else's name in terms of keeping the press honest. And Jay Rosen is another one. And he took note of how we referenced that Washington Post headline earlier. The headline reads, Garland vowed to depoliticize justice. Then the FBI searched Mar-a-Lago. And it was Jay Rosen who noted that the Post had to go back. They changed the headline to FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago lands Merrick Garland in a political firestorm. So they take less of the political motive off of Garland, but not right. entirely so. There are a couple of others that I want to name just out of frustration. And for me, the two, and these are the poster children for but her emails, are Chris Saliza of The Washington Post and Andrea Mitchell from NBC News. Both have moments where they are extremely capable reporters, but I just could not figure out what it was in 2016 with the emails, with those two especially. It's, you know, whatever it was, I just found myself looking at the TV and saying, you will just not let this go when it is so out of proportion.
Right, right. But it was in proportion to their goal to look so objective that they could find that they could make it, you know, Trump like grabbing some woman's private parts and bragging about it equal to Hillary, you know, not following 100% the procedures on documents. Interestingly, what Hillary did with the emails is something that almost every member of the Trump White House did when they got in. You know, they found Ivanka doing this exact same thing, even worse. And, you know, so it's like, so it was just a BS issue. But the email thing served for the news media as a vehicle for them to be able to say something bad about Hillary so they looked objective. And that's the whole thing about this idea that we have to look objective. How about looking accurate? How about looking truthful? How about looking factual? Those are the things that should happen. The other thing I want to mention about DC is that there's a big problem with access journalism. There's a huge problem where they have to, where, you know, ABC wants to get like an exclusive kind of walkthrough of the White House with Trump. And so they, you know, curry favor with them. They want to get that over CBS. And so when they get that big walkthrough interview, like they did early on in the Trump administration, they pull their punches and they're not hard hitting. Because they want to be asked back. And that's the thing. I mean, in Chicago, we, in an unaired part of the ABC interview the week after Trump took office, Trump lied about violence in Chicago, just flat out lied. And they wouldn't give us the video. We saw it on a transcript. They wouldn't give it to us, and they didn't ever report it. ABC didn't. And I'm convinced that was it. Access journalism. They wanted to be invited back, so they didn't want to make Trump mad.
And the last note I want to say about stenography, and yes, this is most egregious on Twitter, but you see it in mainstream, like TV coverage as well, is they don't consider it stenography when they say, well, we're just showing you what they said and then you can decide on it. And like here's a Maggie Haberman tweet where it just says, Eric Trump to Fox, give me a break. Joe Biden signed off on this. But then there's nothing that follows up that says, but this is not true. Right. And yeah, Twitter only has so many characters, but you have endless time in a 24/7 news cycle to be thorough and factual about what you're saying. Mark Jacob, do you want to stick around for one more little
sure.
segment here?
Happy
okay,
to.
Let's do that. We'll take a break and then we'll wrap up this hour after this here up north. Wisconsin. There we go. Another rainy day in western Wisconsin. Hopefully we get enough out of our system to we've got some drought conditions that are starting to show up on the maps here across the northern part of the state. So hopefully we get a little bit of relief before we resume our summer already in progress. Mark Jacob with us for one more segment here, former editor at the Chicago Tribune and Sun-Times. We're talking about how the media covers democracy and politics these days. Sunday mornings are always an adventure. And for example, Florida Senator Rick Scott was on with Face of the Nation rather on CBS. Right. And you hear Rick Scott's name probably a little more often in Wisconsin than you normally would, simply because he has put out a plan and he is the head of, you know, the Senate Republican campaign committee. And his plan would lead to, you know, big cuts to Medicare and Social Security. And he talks about, you know, cutting costs for Medicare. And so when CBS's Margaret Brennan politely corrected him, you know, you and others correctly put, he knows that this is a lie. So why doesn't she just go ahead and say, Senator Scott, why are you lying about right. Medicare costs?
Right. The idea that cutting Medicare costs is the same thing as cutting Medicare is outrageously dishonest. And yet he's going to go on a nationwide TV show and pretend that's the case. I mean, that's such an insult to the viewers and to everyone. And so, but she is very politely, she says, well, you realize that there's a difference between cutting costs and cutting benefits. And good for her doing that, although she's not really that tough on most people she interviews. But really, that's where you just stop the show. And that's where you stop the show and say, Senator Scott, you know that they're not cutting Medicare. They're cutting Medicare costs, which is a good thing for consumers. You know that. You know they're not. That nobody's going to lose any benefits whatsoever. You know that. Why are you lying about this issue? That would be good television, and that would also be good journalism.
It would be, and we used to see it. And I don't mean to be accused of the beatification of Tim Russert, but I'm going to engage in this because we're not. I don't feel like we're romanticizing the past mm-hmm. when we say this is the kind of thing where Tim Russert did put up a big stop sign and go, hold on. And not only did he stop a guest, but he already had the Chiron ready. He already had the graphics ready. Here's what you said before. And I know that sounds a lot like old guys talking about the good old days, but my memory, I think, is pretty clear on that. And in the sense that it wasn't that he was so great. It's that since that time, so few people have risen to that level.
I think it goes back to the access issue, because when you think about how seldom Republicans will go on regular news media these days, that they you know hide behind the Fox News a barrier. And for example, like Herschel Walker, for example.
Oh, geez.
You're not going to see him on any of those shows because he's been hit too many times or during football games, apparently, because he's mm-hmm. really not able to discuss issues. He's just a mess, which is an insult to the electorate committed by both McConnell and Trump, who both endorsed him. But so they're hiding their terrible politicians. Only a few will venture out from behind the wall to go on these national news shows. And that's why I think some of the news shows feel like they have to treat them with kid gloves. Because if they don't, because if these Republicans do not go on their air anymore, then they're in real trouble as far as their pretense that they're being objective. That threatens their ability to say that, well, we're fair to everyone if the Republicans won't go on. So I think that's part of why they're so nice to liars on TV.
And I think that part of the reason they need to get over that is that it's not the marketplace it used to be, where if you didn't get them on your show, you wouldn't have any access to what they're saying. But we now have an ecosystem where they are appearing on Fox or on, you know, One America or Newsmax, right, whatever they are. And you don't have to have them as a guest to play the clips back, right, from what they have said. And then either the journalist or an expert can dissect it from there.
Right. Totally right. Totally right. And that would be a far better approach. And, you know, the thing about it is, you know, I was railing yesterday about the fact that they had Mick Mulvaney on CNN, just a lie, like he does all the time. And, you know, they had Kellyanne Conway a few weeks ago. And I'm thinking, who did they not have on their show while they were having those people on? You know, there's a thing in programming, where in TV programming, where you really want to go. That's why they pay people to be on TV, because they know if they call them, they have to show up. And but it's, you know, it's 24/7. They have to keep going. It's hard to get people to show up sometimes when they're supposed to. But TV needs to try a lot harder to diversify its voices, in my opinion. I would love to, like the professor we had on a few minutes ago, who was terrific. Just find experts, find people who know things, find smart people, put them on the air. Don't put the same old goofs. Don't put John Bolton on the air just because his publicist said he was available. Don't do that. And it's, to a large extent, TV news is so bad because they don't want to work hard enough to make it better.
It's performance. And yeah, that's not how it started. And it's not how it should be. Let's turn to the January 6th committee, which prior to this summer's hearings, I didn't know, you know, what, if anything, was going to come of it. And then they had, you know, again, forgive the entertainment framing, but they had the summer blockbuster. Yeah. And it got a lot of people to say, oh, wait a minute, you know, about Trump, people who had supported him. But, you know, the American attention span is what it is. Mm-hmm. And so it leads to this question. Yes, during the summer, in a lot of focus groups, people that suddenly showed they were less inclined to support Trump might now start to, you know, drift back the other way, especially now after the search warrants and everything else. What's your own sense of, between now and the midterm elections, what the January 6th committee is going to do, and or the Department of Justice, and whether any of this will have true impact?
Well, I don't think we're going to find out anything as far as charges from the DOJ. I think we may get more subpoenas and may get more people like Scott Perry get their phones seized and stuff like that, which I think will be great because it'll show that they're on the case. But I don't think we're going to get that. I do think that the J6 committee will be back and we'll probably have more hearings. I hope they will. It sounds like they're getting more evidence. And those hearings have been terrific. I mean, they've been so well constructed. They've not been boring at all. They've been interesting. They've had to just show the evidence, and they've been quoting a lot of Republicans. This is not this idea that it's partisan. You know, well, how come all the Republicans are exposing Trump's crimes? So I think it's been very effective. I mean, some people you're never going to convince some people, but it's been very effective.
All right. Mark Jacob, this was great. Thanks so much. Look forward to chatting with you again real soon.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks, Pat.
All right. Have a great weekend.
You too.
We'll take a break. More coming up in our next hour. You're up north.